At the dawn of its creation, Second Life was a vast virtual prairie studded with mountains and lakes, home to a rugged few.
It was very much like when Native Americans were roaming the country, and it was relatively Arcadian.
James Au is a reporter in the real world hired by Linden Lab back in early 2003 when the game was still in the experimental or beta stage as its first embedded reporter. Au watched as the swelling population transformed the landscape and in the process transformed Arcadia into America.
Because what happened immediately after the beta period was a group that came from another game called World War II Online discovered Second Life, and they jumped into it en masse. Over 100 of them came in, and they started building tanks and fortresses and shooting people. And they actually took over an area that was meant to be a free fire zone, but the original Second Life settlers were kind of living there peacefully, and so they just jammed into this free fire zone area, and they started killing the original natives. And so that became a big battle.
Second Life continued to relive American history with a revolution. Linden Lab was charging people for the things they built to fill the empty spaces of their world, because all that digital construction was overloading their servers.
So what they did is put a tax on that, and you'd have Linden dollars deducted from your account. But what happened was there was a group called Americana, and they were creating an area that would be tribute to American icons, like the Washington Monument, Fenway Park. And this was meant as a public works project, but they were getting taxed up the wazoo because it took a lot of objects to create this, a lot of building blocks. And finally, they say, look, because they're an Americana group, they launched a tax revolt. And their leader was this cat, Fleabite Beach. And Fleabite Beach sent out a Henry David Thoreau declaration against Mad King Linden. And they covered the whole Americana area with giant tea crates. And they set the Route 66 driveway on fire.
Soon after, Linden Lab ended the tax system, ushering in an era of unbridled commerce fueled by Linden dollars, purchasable by credit card at the current rate of 300 to the U.S. dollar. Now, instead of taxes, people pay Linden Lab for the land they buy, spruce it up with new content like buildings and trees, rent it for virtual money that they can then trade in for cold, hard cash.
There's a woman named Anshe Chung, and she makes an estimated $150,000 a year and owns a whole continent. And she's actually set up a shop of content creators in China to outsource 3D development.
With its population growing by more than 25% a month, Second Life is an increasingly popular world, but some locations are more popular than others, hence the land boom. It's also a very social world. People go to a lot of parties and they want to be all that they can be, or someone they can't otherwise be. So there's a design boom, too.
The top fashion designers make upwards of $70,000 a year. That's people who create fashions for avatars, clothes, shoes, also hair. Hair extensions are really popular. Jewelry, what are called skins, which is kind of like a full-body tattoo.
Jane McGonigal is an expert in the field of participatory gaming and what's called immersive play.
The most interesting thing about Second Life is how intrigued its residents are by playing with the line between the virtual life or Second Life and their real lives, or what they call their first lives. You know, you've got mixed reality parties.
That's when you go to a real life party and the Second Life version is projected on a wall.
So you can see people you know who aren't in the same city, who are in a virtual version of the room that you are in having an actual party.
A real life musician even staged a virtual concert in Second Life.
Hello out there. Hello in here. This event is the first time a major recording artist has performed live in avatar form. And without further ado, Suzanne Vega.
But it's not all fun and games, Jane McGonigal.
And you have real-world psychologists who have set up shop in Second Life who are offering mental health services to people who, in their real lives, have mental health needs.
James Au has even written about Second Life detective agencies, which specialize in catching virtual adulterers.
The detective will set up a sting operation, a honey trap, where they'll put a hot male or female babe into the setting with the client's suspected unfaithful partner and see if they take the bait.
But as you pointed out in your story, when the hot babe sting operation takes place, almost every single male avatar folds like a house of cards within seconds.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of it going on.
Second Life is so much like real life, it even harbors real-life anxiety about addictive, antisocial, productivity-shriveling video games. Science and technology writer Clive Thompson.
I actually wrote a story a while ago about an Australian inside the game who created a little video game called Tringo, and it's sort of a mix of bingo and Tetris. It's a lot of fun. It's enormously fun.
So the Australian invited Second Life pals over to a Second Life place to try the game and buy it and take it back to their virtual apartments to play. He sold enough of them to earn about 4,000 real dollars. Tringo became so popular, in fact, that it became a threat.
Yeah, because Second Life is not really a game, because it is a social environment, there's a lot of emphasis put on the socializing, on the talking, on the making stuff, on the hosting of parties, on the visiting other people, on being creative. And so suddenly people were logging into Second Life just to go and sort of sit in front of a Tringo game with a dozen other people sort of playing Tringo. So the thing that people were saying about it was that this game is ruining the quality of life inside Second Life. And this cracked me up because, of course, it was people complaining that a game was ruining life inside a game.
I asked Clive to take me in.
Here we go, logging in.
I chose a name, an avatar. It's kind of cool picking a whole new look. And he sent me sailing over the landscape of Second Life.
Now here you are. There you are in your outfit. You've got sort of nice little sort of dirty jeans on.
I look pretty hot, I have to admit.
Yeah, you look great. Here's something fun. I'll just show you. Here we can fly.
Whoa! We land where some people are milling around, and suddenly a song comes up. Master and Slave Toy Store.
Yeah,
that's where we are.
Yeah,
gee, thanks
see.
For taking me here, Clive.
No problem. Yeah, I aim to please.
There's a guy. Let's go up to him. Ask whether he comes here often.
Yeah, sure.
Heya. I didn't ask you to say heya.
Nice way to start a conversation.
Greetings, lady. Ask, are they in the market for something? Alan Taney said, to find somebody interested by spankings. I don't think he's really an English speaker.
All right, well, we'll just head out.
Now, they say the more you go in, the more friends you make, the richer the experience in Second Life, where activities range from getting and spending and building and selling to flirting to flying to inventing stuff to self-invention and to spanking, I suppose. But I asked Clive, why bother when you can do all that stuff in the real world?
Yeah, that's true. The difference is that Second Life is a lot more beautiful than the real world.
On a flat screen made of pixels with pixelated people, I mean, how persuasive is that kind of beauty?
Well, it's pretty persuasive if you live, you know, in an industrial park in Ohio. A lot of people inside these games live in incredibly boring places, locked into incredibly boring jobs. You have to ask yourself, which is fundamentally a more fun reality?
There's definitely a sense that you have a little more creative control and personal power in Second Life.
Jane McGonigal.
I mean, the question is, do gamers and residents of virtual worlds want to role play or do they want to real play? Anytime you talk to a World of Warcraft player, they talk about it as a way of escaping the regular life. And you don't really hear that from residents of Second Life. It's very much an integral part of their identity and their lives.
I want to go play in somebody else's world.
Edward Castronova writes about the economics of online games. He says that the profit motive built into Second Life tracks pretty much with reality. That's why he doesn't spend too much time there. He prefers fantasy games like EverQuest, where, unlike Second Life and the real world, you don't set your own goals. Your tasks, whether grand or mundane, as, say, carrying some gold to the next village, are all designed for you. And all important in that world.
The fantasy worlds, they focus not on commerce per se, although there's plenty of commerce, but I think what really attracts people to them is the map of meaning, the fantasy that creates good and evil and puts significance behind what people are doing. Every time you do something in one of the fantasy virtual worlds, you are told that you matter. And that is something missing from the real world economy.
In his free time, he prefers his meaning ready-made. That's more fun. Fun is fundamental to all virtual worlds. And this, says Castronova, has policy implications for the real world.
Let's look at this Iraq war as a game designer would. Let's say we're making a part of the game environment of our people, and we want them to be happier. And then you might think, gosh, that's why Iraq 1 was more fun than Iraq 2. Iraq 1 had a victory condition. You know, it was limited in time. It didn't go on forever, and so on and so forth. And I'm not suggesting that we really should do policy this way right now. What I'm suggesting is that over the next 100 years, as more and more people grow up familiar with game design as a part of their policy environment within these games, we will see increasing pressure and new insights in real-world policy where people go, now is that the funnest inflation rate that they could have designed? Don't we want a more fun one than that? And we're going to have to deal with this.
What he's saying is you may not get the world online, but sooner or later that world is going to get you. You'll see game thinking play out in tax policy. You'll see it in education. You may even see it in war planning. We like to play, and politics is the biggest game of all. Maybe that's why Mark Warner, an early adopter, jumped into Second Life so soon.
And you know what I'd say to any of the other potential candidates? Yeah, come on in. The virtual world water is fine.
And the shopping's even better. You can even buy a whole new face, which could come in handy if you're running for office.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Mark Jerkowitz. Bob Garfield will be back next week.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.